We'd like to read and comment on a koan, number 53, from the Hekigan Rohu. It's Hyakujo's Wild Ducks. And the introduction reads, "The whole world is unveiled. All lies entirely open. He encounters situations unobstructed. With every move, he has complete independence. In all his talk, there is no I. Yet, still he has the power to kill. But say, in the end, where do the ancients rest? To test, I'm citing this old case. Once when Mao Tzu and Pai Chang, that's Hyakujo, were walking together, they saw some wild ducks fly by. The great master asked, 'What is it?' Hyakujo replied, 'Wild ducks.' 'Where is it?' Hyakujo said, 'They've flown away.' Mao Tzu twisted Hyakujo's nose. Hyakujo cried out in pain. The great master said, 'When have they ever flown away?'" And then the verse says, "Wild ducks, who knows where they are? Mao Tzu has seen, talked, taught, and exhausted the meaning of mountain cloud and moonlit seas. But Hyakujo did not understand and said, 'They've flown away.' Hyakujo wanted to fly away, but Mao Tzu held him fast. 'Speak, speak.'" So let's just briefly look at the introduction. And it says, "The whole world is unveiled. All lies entirely open." Remember when the Emperor Wu asked Bodhidharma, "What is your teaching?" And Bodhidharma said, "Vast emptiness, not a thing that can be called holy." The whole world is unveiled. All lies entirely open. We also remember that Nunsen said that everyday mind is the way. Or if you like, you are everyday mind. Or Mu is everyday mind. But then he said later, "It's like vast space. Where is there room for good and bad?" We mustn't see this in terms of an extended space. It's not space as extended. When Nansen says it is like vast space, it means that everyday mind is completely unobstructed. This feeling that we are obstructed, that we are imprisoned, that we are limited, that we are frustrated, comes about because of our tendency to turn constantly in on ourselves. We refer everything back to ourselves. There was somebody said, I forget what it was, oh yes, it was the 9/11 disaster. And a woman said, and the worst part about it was I had to miss my hair appointment. It's this capacity to refer everything back. As we say, if something happens in China, 10,000 people die. Well, that's terrible, terrible. 100 people die in the States. Well, that's awful. 10 people die in Montreal. Oh, gosh, 10 people. And one person dies in our family. and that's the end of the world. And we likened this in one of the talks we've given to a whirlpool. And this is very apt metaphor, that we don't flow in the stream of events. It's that we flow back into ourselves constantly. And the whole question is, how can we let go of this? And letting go of this, we will see that the world has always been unveiled. It has always lay entirely open. This view of referring back to ourselves is the illusion. It is this that has no substance. And then the introduction goes on to say, he encounters situations unobstructed. He's now talking about Matsu. Unobstructed. And it is this non-obstructed quality that is the quality of freedom. Let me say again that we are here in order to see into our true nature. When we begin a session, we often say that don't come here for understanding or wisdom. Don't come here for being a better person, having a more loving personality, and so on. We are here for one reason, and that is to see into our true nature. It's just like Ta Hui says. He says, never mind about the leaves, the branches, the flowers and the fruit. Go for the root. Cut the root. And to mess around wanting to trim the weed constantly in order to make it one way or other more elegant is simply a waste of time. He says, with every move, he has complete independence. It's really non-dependence. It's not so much independence. Independence suggests a kind of separateness, aloofness, apartness. But non-dependence means that one can be totally involved, totally taken up with the situation, and yet not dependent on the outcome of that situation. It is when we become worried about the fruit that our problems arise. If one is a creative person, one creates because of the process of creativity, not because people are going to admire one's creation. Once one gets into that, then the whole thing becomes superficial and just throwing words or paint or whatever at the wall. And it says, in all his talk, there is no I. That's the personal pronoun, I, not the thing they see through. In all his talk, there is no I. And this, of course, would be a very remarkable person. In other words, there is no self-reflection. There is nothing reflected back. And he says, yet he still has the power to kill. What is this power to kill? It's one of these statements, hyperbole of Zen. It's exaggerating in order to make the point. In other words, he will cut through people's ignorance and people's deluded views about what the world is about and what they are about. So before going on to the koan, I thought it'd be an idea to read something of Hyakujo's teachings. One of the things he said, which is very interesting, and that is he said that if you penetrate one place, you penetrate 10,000. Another master put it slightly differently when he said, if you see through a speck of dust, you see through the whole universe. And it is this seeing through one speck of dust, rather than rushing around trying to see through the 10,000 things. See through what is essential. What is the root of it all? What is it that truly matters? One way, of course, one can put it, is to see into this insistence that one is in control of one's life. It is this constant trying to manoeuvre things, trying to change things, trying to ensure that things don't happen or they do happen. And we do it all within the mind. The control that we exercise is over the muscles of the diaphragm. When we say this, people feel that we're talking about the idea of going out of control. And we're not talking about going out of control. A person that goes out of control is a person that is over-controlled. The whole system breaks down because there is too much control. When you walk, you walk, and it's perfectly controlled. In other words, every step that is taken with the right amount of energy, the right amount of balance, the right amount of momentum. And when you speak, the right words are used. They flow out in the correct order, with the correct emphasis, with the correct accent, and if you're multilingual, with the right language. And when you see quite spontaneously. You see it as a whole, depending on the context of the perception. In other words, there is a marvellous, wonderful, if I'm going to call it this thing, this way, a controlling instrument going on. Of course, there's no controlling instrument, but we do have to use words. That everything is marvellously maintained. And we see this in terms of the growth of organisms. There are billions of children have been born over the centuries. And relatively few, very few of those, have been misformed. All of them, probably all of them, have come out perfectly formed. It's like the flowers and the trees and the birds and the fish and the animals and the ants. There's this marvellous formative power, this creative formative power, which is constantly at work. And we are the outcome of this. When we say that, we as its manifestation, we are its manifestation, we manifest it to the full. And the problem is we have that capacity to usurp its power. And usurping its power in this way turns it back on itself, and then we become miserable, isolated, alienated individuals. And the questioner asks, according to the sutras, the indestructible diamond body is imperceptible, yet it clearly sees. It is free from discrimination, and yet there is nothing which it does not comprehend. What does this mean? First of all, there is this, the indestructible diamond body. This is mu, or this is hu, or This is the sound of one hand clapping. The indestructible diamond body. And the interesting thing is this diamond. You know, it is said that a diamond can cut everything, but nothing can cut a diamond, except another diamond, I believe. However, the point is I think we said this before in one of the other Tay shows, but it's worth repeating. And that is that when we are living our inverted state, when we see everything upside down, which is the normal view of the unenlightened person, then the world is real. The world is solid. The world matters. The world is it. And the self, or whatever it is a wispy phantom in the machine. Or, nowadays, it's denied altogether. But when we see, or when we awaken, rather, to the truth is that we are the reality. We are that diamond, indestructible diamond body. That dual mirror samadhi. And when we're looking working with mu or hu, this is what we are opening ourselves to the truth. This is how it is right now. But because of our deluded state, we see the world and we see the whole situation as being something of a menace that we have to cope with, we have to relate to, we have to do something about. And the questioner says, it is imperceptible. And this is true. As we say, you cannot know yourself. It is impossible. You can know an idea of yourself. You can see a reflection of yourself. But you are not accessible through any of the five, or as some told you said, the six senses. You cannot grasp yourself. This is what is meant by the diamond body is imperceptible. Yet it clearly sees. And this is what we take for granted. This miracle of perception, this miracle of seeing, or the miracle of knowing. And it is in our sleep that we take this for granted. The wonder of being is lost to us. And it is free from discrimination. And yet there is nothing which it does not comprehend. It is open to everything. Everything is taken in. This is the remarkable thing. There is a slight sound and it is heard. There is a slight breeze and it is felt. There is a slight smell and it is smelled. Everything is comprehended or registered. Perhaps we would also use the word registered. Everything is taken in. What does this mean? And Hyakujo says, it is imperceptible because its own nature is formless and intangible. Hence, it is called imperceptible. And this is really where it causes many people consternation. We're dealing with what is formless and intangible, and so therefore it is unreal in their minds. And they want to get on with something real. They want to deal with something that is meaningful, they say. I was rather shocked last night when one of the members, a long-time member as a matter of fact, told me that my teaching was unrelated to life. When the whole purpose is being open to this glorious life, no longer taking it for granted, no longer having it masked from us, with this kind of closed-in attitude. It is formless and intangible. You are formless and intangible. And it is awakening, because you're trying to reach outside, because you think the experience is important, this kind of experience or that kind of experience is important, that the whole point and direction is lost. And since it is intangible, it is seen to be profoundly still and neither vanishing nor appearing. And we've seen this, we were talking about this very aspect a little while ago when we talked about the immutability. It is immutable. And when he talks about still, we have to be very careful how we interpret that. He does not mean static. There was a master that spoke about the ringing of stillness, the vibrancy, the aliveness of stillness. And then he says, though not apart from our world, the worldly stream cannot influence it. We are, the world is its manifestation. Everything appears, everything shows it to be. Everything is it. And it's this that he means, that it is not apart from our world. It is not a cosmic consciousness that floats. It's not some abstract idea. It is the reality of reality. It is the light of light. But the worldly stream cannot influence it. And as we say, you cannot be touched by anything. Nothing can touch you. Nothing can hurt you. Even death itself cannot touch you. It is self-possessed and sovereign. Self-possessed and sovereign. It's often looked upon as a light that shines by itself. It has no cause. It has no reason for being. It has no creator. And in that it is sovereign. And in that it is self-possessed. Which is the reason why it clearly sees. It is free from discrimination in that its own nature is formless and basically undifferentiated. In other words, because it is formless, all forms are registered by it. It comprehending everything means that the undifferentiated is endowed with functions as countless as the sands of the Ganges. And if all phenomena were to be discerned simultaneously, it would comprehend all of them without exception. As I say, register would be a better word than comprehend. It registers it. It responds. It is immediately responsive. It is spontaneous. There is a total spontaneity. There is no a gap. There is no distance between the perception and the reaction. In the sutra it is written, Prajna, unknowing, knoweth all. Prajna, unknowing, knoweth all. Remember Bodhidharma, when he said, the Emperor Wu said, who are you? He said, I don't know, unknowing. We often say, you are knowing. But Hyakujo says, no, you are unknowing. because it is unknowing, it knows all. And then it says, Prajna, unseeing, sees all. And then the questioner says, there is a sutra that says not to perceive anything in terms of being or non-being is true deliverance. What does that mean? And Hyakujo says, when we attain to purity of mind, that is something real. In other words, it's not another state of mind. It's not another idea. We don't have a better idea about the world or about ourselves. We don't change our opinions. We are dealing now with reality. This person always remembers. We can remember where we were and what we were doing. We were crossing the street in Chatham, southwest Ontario, when it suddenly struck us. My God, this practice is real. It is real. And if you feel that we're out of touch with reality or out of touch with life, then you haven't seen into this marvelous truth. We are dealing with reality here. When we attain to purity of mind, that is something real. When this happens, our remaining free from any thought of achievement is called not perceiving anything as existent. In other words, when one is awakened, truly awakened, one does not say to oneself, oh good, I'm awakened. And there is no condition really that is the condition of being awakened. There is a condition of being asleep, but there is no condition of being awakened. Or perhaps we could put this the other way. There is only the condition of being awakened. There is no condition really of being asleep. Do you see those two statements are saying exactly the same thing? The sleep is the illusion. The waking state is a reality. To let go of the one is not to attain the other. While reaching the state in which no thoughts arise or persist, yet without being conscious of their absence, is called not perceiving anything as non-existent. Reaching the state in which no thoughts arise or persist, yet without being conscious of their absence. And this, of course, is the condition of samadhi. There is a very deep samadhi in which there are no thoughts that arise. And of course, they don't arise, they don't persist. But one's not aware in that state of there being an absence of thought. Now, our true state, self, is samadhi. We are always in samadhi. There's that koan, the woman comes out of samadhi, in which Manjushri tries to get this woman out of samadhi, and he fails. He uses all of his magic, but he cannot get her out of samadhi. And yet Mumyo, who is the symbol of the intellectual mind, just comes along, flicks his fingers, and she's out of samadhi. Now, the interesting thing is that her natural state is samadhi. This is why Manjushri cannot get her out of samadhi. We are distracted by Mumyo. and that gives the appearance that we are now out of samadhi. We get immersed in the world of the 10,000 things. We get tied up, we get mixed up in the ongoingness of life. What matters in life and what doesn't matter in life, and so on. But nevertheless, the condition of samadhi, of no thoughts arising, is still true. It is part of the illusion that the thoughts themselves are real, that the thoughts themselves are something. When we are sitting, it's sometimes worthwhile, because if we're invaded by thoughts, to just say, okay, to the thoughts, okay, come on then, come up, let's see now. And when one turns then, they're no longer there. They're not there anymore. It's only when we sort of look away, so to say, that the thoughts seem to flood back in again. The thoughts seem to be real. And then we add an emotional element to the thought, and then it becomes not only real, but influential. It can influence the way we act, the way we are. But you've seen this, you must have seen this, that even in the most terrible anguish, one can be in a really bad state. Someone in the family has just died, for example, or there's been a real tragedy in the family for one reason or another, and one is tied in with it, one's hurt by it, and so on. And yet, every now and again, it's almost as though the clouds part and there is blue sky there. There's a kind of serenity, a kind of a bliss. One feels blessed in a way at that moment. Now, it isn't that the clouds are really the reality and the blue sky is one of those experiences, sort of an illusory experience. It is the clouds that are the illusory experience. The blue sky is the reality. This is what is always wonderful when one flies, when one takes off and it's pouring with rain and the clouds are quite heavy, and one goes through these clouds and all of a sudden, there it is, glorious blue sky. The blue sky was always there. The blue sky is always there. We are always in samadhi. And it is this, the work that we do is in order to allow these clouds to become more and more transparent. Whether we can live in a life with a bright blue sky all day, all night, I don't know. It certainly, this person hasn't had that privilege by any means as yet. And it may very well be that this is a kind of ideal that we can work towards. Some people claim that they have got this, and they may be right, but it is not my experience, and I can only go on my experience. But nevertheless, once one realizes truly, not in a kind of theoretical way, but once one has seen it for oneself, that the blue sky is always there, then the clouds no longer have their power. They do come and they do go. Life has still got its problems. One still has got difficulties and so on to deal with, and one still does get involved in dealing with them. But, if you like, there is a kind of background of eternity, to use this phrase that Spinoza used, this background of blue sky, and that is never absent. So it is written, not to perceive anything in terms of being and not being is true deliverance. see if we've got time for one more. The Sarangama Sutra says, perception of things employed as a basis for building up positive concepts is the origin of all ignorance. Perception that there is nothing to perceive, that is nirvana, also known as deliverance. You see, this is when we're working on mu, this is really what we're working with. Joshu said no. And this means that the no is like a sword that cuts through everything. Everything is seen to have its to not have any basic self nature. It has no enduring core or substance at all. We tried to bring this out the other day with the mirror, that the reflections have no substance, they've got no self-nature. Their reality is given entirely by the mirror. And to say perception of things, in other words, one feels that things have in fact got their own reality, their own substantial state, is the origin of all ignorance. And this not only means things in the world like objects and so on, but it also means feelings and experiences, emotions and so on. We give those, we make them into something, that we give them their own independent existence. We say that they are real. The depression that I feel is really a real depression, or the anger that I feel is real anger. And yet, it can only be sustained by the true self or awareness or whatever you're going to call it, by the mirror, if we're going to use that metaphor. And mu is seeing into this. Mu is ensuring that we're no longer taken in by this illusory nature of things. So let's go on to the koan then. He says, one day Matsu and Hyakujo were walking together when they saw some wild ducks fly by. Now, it's interesting that so often the koans take place in some particular situation. There's the flax, Tozan weighing the flax, or a Toku-san wandering backwards and forwards waiting for supper, or the other Tozan arriving wanting to have a night in the temple and so on. In other words, it is within life itself that the koan so often arise. It's like the very koan, the koan mu. A monk asked Joshu, does the dog have a Buddha nature? And we've said so often that you must see, you must be the monk. The monk has your anguish, your concern. The monk was undoubtedly afraid of death. He was afraid of life. There was a sense of insecurity, vulnerability, and so on, that is the lot of any sensitive human being. And he wanted something stable. And he asked Joshua for this. He was expecting Joshua to say yes, and Joshua said no. So in other words, you've got a whole drama there, a whole thing that is going on. And this thing that is going on is your life. See it in those terms. This is why we have koans, because they are concrete. And they saw some ducks fly by. And the great master asked, what is it? what was that question about? Why was he asking that question? What is it? that sometimes that there was a master held up a stick. He said, "What is this? What is this? How are you going to respond?" And Hyakujo, who was not with it, replied, "Wild ducks." What about that? It was an answer that deserved a beating. He wasn't there. Wild ducks. But if wild ducks doesn't work, what are they? What is it? And it's exactly the same with this Zendo. What is it? Or the cushions. What is it? It is because you are separate from them. It's over there. The cushions are one thing, you are something else. And because of that, you get into all of this business of wanting to relate and wanting to be part of or wanting to belong and all the rest of it. The ducks were over there as far as Hyakujo was concerned. I'm here, the ducks are there. Because it's sort of borne out by the next statement. "Where is it?" Matsu asked. This is the other side to the question, of course, where are you from? Where are you from, or where are the ducks, are the same question. You remember Dozen arrived at the Oman's place. And Oman asked him, where are you from? And he says, "South of the lake, north of the river." And Oman hit the roof. This monk, it was supposed to be a monk, and he's fast asleep. So they're flown away, and Matsu twisted Pai Chang's nose. Now, what about that? The koan really, well, it resolves around two things. One is the question, where is it? And the next one is, why does Matsu twist Pai Chang's nose? What is he doing there? In order to see this, you have to be Pai Chang, you have to be Hyakujo. You're sort of wandering in a daze, really. This is how it was with Hyakujo. He wasn't there. He wasn't all there. And Matsu says, "What is it?" He says, "The ducks." A purely sort of dead response. He says, "Where are they?" He says, "They've flown away. They're over there, I'm over here." So they've flown away. And then all of a sudden there's this enormous pain of the nose. What about that? What does that say? What is that? And then there's the verse. Wild ducks, who knows where they are? Well, where are the wild ducks? Where is this Zendo? You say, well, it's in Ahuntsic, or it's in Montreal, or it's in Quebec, or it's in Canada, or it's on the planet. What about those answers? Is that where it is? Now let's have a, supposing there are no words for location, now where is it? Where are you? Where is anything? You have to pin down something which is a focal point. Something has to be somewhere in order for anything to be anywhere. This is one of the points that was very much of great concern to the ancients. And the business of setting up a central point a world centre, a world naval, was of primary importance as far as they were concerned. This was gave what they felt was sacred space that was bringing the world into existence. But supposing you that this sacred centre is everywhere, perhaps supposing it's not fixed. Now where are you? And he says, who knows where they are? And then he says, Matsu has seen, talked, taught, and exhausted the meaning of cloud and moonlit seas. In other words, Matsu has given his guts. He's done everything possible in order to bring home the truth as far as he is able. He's talked, taught, and exhausted the meaning of mountain cloud and moonlit seas. But Chang did not understand and said, they've flown away.
All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.